Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to Elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Welcome to this week's episode of Brainwaves. Tonight's episode is a part one of a two-part series featuring artists Professor Ken Wilder and Dr. Aaron McPeak. Over the next 2 weeks, we'll be broadcasting our discussion with them about the Beyond the Visual exhibition, which they both curated. Beyond the Visual is an art exhibition developed in close collaboration with blind and partially blind artists, curators, and audiences. The curators hope that the exhibition will inspire institutional change and pave the way for galleries and museums to follow its example, redefining what galleries can be. Hello and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR, 8:55am, 3CR Digital Radio, and online at 3cr.com.au. I'm Mark, and joining me today are artists Professor Ken Wilder and Dr. Aaron McPeak. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, Mark, that's fine.
Ken is Professor of Aesthetics at the University of the Arts, London, and Aaron is an Associate Lecturer at Chelsea College of Arts, also part of the University of the Arts, London. They're with us this evening to talk about barriers in arts funding for people with disabilities and to share insights from Beyond the Visual, the exhibition they both curated and participated in. Welcome to Brainwaves, Ken and Aaron. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting us.
No problem. Yeah, I suppose, first of all, can you both share a bit about your involvement in the arts and how you both got involved in the arts?
Well, I've kind of always been involved in arts practices. And for many, many years, I worked as a stage lighting technician and designer until I lost sight. But prior to that, I always made sculpture, painting, photography. I was always interested and always doing things, and I had exhibited in the 80s and 90s. I became registered blind in 2002, so I kind of took that as an opportunity to go to art school and begin an arts degree, which I did at St. Martin's, and then went on to do a PhD and teacher training at Chelsea and the London College of Fashion. So I've kind of always been involved. I'm quite greedy for using different media and materials. It's a constant source of exploration. So it's therapeutic as well as being a serious creative process. So I try to kind of hook those both of those things together. I could go on for maybe 2 or 3 months, but I think I'll leave it at that, if that's all right, Mark.
Yeah, no problem. And Ken, what about yourself?
I originally studied architecture at the Royal College of Art, and although I never fully qualified as an architect, I worked in architectural practice for some 10 years. But actually then started to teach interior and spatial design at Chelsea College of Arts way back in 1993. and set up the MA course in interior spatial design there. So I've always had a kind of spatial aspect to my practice, architectural aspect to my practice, but something that was very particular to the courses at Chelsea is that they weren't taught just by designers and architects, but by artists, performance artists, video artists, etc. And that kind of expanded my way of thinking about space. And so my own practice shifted towards, you could say, a fine art practice, which I've been doing really since the late 1990s. But I've kind of retained this interest and this concern with space. And I suppose if I had to say where my practice lies, it's probably somewhere between architecture and fine art practice. I'm very interested in the context, the situation in which the artwork is placed. And my writing, I've written a couple of books, one with Aaron called Beyond the Visual, that's directly connected to the project, but another book, which in a way was a kind of impetus for this project called Beholding, Situated Art and the Aesthetics of Reception, which very much set out to look at that situated relationship between the beholder and the artwork. We use the term beholder rather than spectator because it's less eye orientated. It's less about vision. It's, we've always insisted that that's a full bodily engagement between you, a multi-sensory engagement between you, the beholder, and the artwork. And so that's my kind of real area of concern.
Could you tell us a little bit about the exhibition you're currently curating and taking part in?
Well, maybe I'll kick off and then Aaron can join in. It's called the exhibition is going to be called Beyond the Visual, but the exhibition really is a result of some 4 or 5 years research now. Originally, we set out with an ambition to set up a research network which is multidisciplinary. It involved artists, involved curators, involved architects, involved psychologists, philosophers, disability arts advocates, etc. So there were a whole range of people coming from different disciplines, which we brought together, working with Tate in London, also the Wellcome Collection, also the Henry Moore Institute, which was our first connection with the Henry Moore Institute, Shape Arts, and which is a disability-led arts organisation, and Vocalise, which deliver a lot of audio description to blind people in the UK. So we had all these amazing partners, and out of that work, which culminated in a 2-day symposium at the Wellcome Collection, the connections we made with the Henry Moore Institute initiated the idea of having an exhibition that started to actually demonstrate to a wider public some of the things that we were discussing in the workshops that we had. And purely by chance, the Arts and Humanities Research Council in the UK put a call out for an exhibition design that had at its heart a commitment to collaborative curatorial processes. Also, they wanted a kind of research project where there was a clearly defined audience that perhaps was being excluded or marginalized. And they also wanted a project that had multiple public engagement activities. So there was only one award. Eventually, they gave two awards, but we were one of those two awards. And I think we ticked all the boxes. And I think we were in a strong position because of the kind of network that went before. But the funding has been fantastic because it's allowed us to expand the remit of that project in a way that we think will directly lead to tangible benefits in terms of how the Henry Moore Institute operate. They've made fundamental changes to their exhibitions. They've introduced audio description. They've introduced new signage. They're looking at access into the building. There's a whole way of thinking about exhibiting sculpture that's been changed as a result of this kind of project. And I think that's the real aim of this project, that it's not just a one-off, but it actually starts to address a kind of fundamental inequality in terms of provision for, in terms of art, artworks for people that are blind or partially blind.
Sorry, just to add to what Ken was saying in terms of the remit or the funding allowing us to do, we've done considerably more than we anticipated, which has been really exciting and, you know, and fantastic. We're working with Yorkshire Sculpture Park, working with Leeds Art Gallery, working with a group of blind musicians and performers, Rotherham Sight and Sound, which we were able to fund them doing some performances. So it's kind of widened out beyond what we'd, you know, not to be sort of overly optimistic, but we've actually done more than we'd hoped to, which has been amazing.
When did the barriers to people with disabilities getting involved in the arts first become apparent to you both, particularly when it comes to funding? And what's the funding for blind and partially sighted people like in the UK currently?
Specifically, there isn't any, is the short answer. There are two very large charities in the UK which are kind of, in many ways, kind of exemplars in their field, but they don't. That would be the Royal National Institute for the Blind and then Guide Dogs for the Blind, who, although they've got a very long history, their kind of connection with the arts has been kind of very peripheral, and you know, they approve of it, but they don't see that as their core remit. And looking at other and talking with others in, you know, in Canada, in the United States, in Norway, in Australia, New Zealand, I'm thinking there was people I've been speaking to recently, that seems to be the same with the blind charities, that their remits seem to be very much around domestic employment, discriminatory behaviours, and kind of combating that. So in terms of the arts, there's really nothing specific from the blind charitable sector. The government funding sector does not make any specific allowances other than a kind of diversity tick box. And I could say the same is true. I was speaking with an artist in Canada about funding recently, because I'm looking at doing another small research project into this sort of specific blindness and arts funding around the world. And the same seems to be true there. Some countries are a little bit more open than others, and some that you would expect to be very far ahead are actually surprisingly still in the 1980s. The short answer is there is no specific funding. You either get approval for the work that you're doing, and in some ways we've taken that approach when we met with the director or the head of the Henry Moore Institute, and they asked, what would you like to get from this exhibition? And our kind of answer was, well, we want the same as you want, which is a critical acclaim, and it's not about, oh look, we've done all this great stuff around blindness. That just happens to be a thematic issue.
So maybe the exception to that is Shape Arts, which Shape Arts were with us right from the start in terms of the network, and they are the other partner along with the Henry Moore Institute for this project. And Shape Arts are not specifically around supporting blindness, it's disability more widely, but they've been fantastically supportive within this project. And the Adam Reynolds Award has been for this year has been awarded to one of the participatory artists who's blind in the exhibition, David Johnson, which has enabled him to make two new works for the exhibition.
besides the lack of funding, which it's apparently non-existent, what are some other barriers that create difficulties for blind people and partially blind people and people with other disabilities getting involved in the arts?
I think this kind of convention that's become kind of dominant within gallery spaces with three-dimensional art of not being able to touch. That, you know, in a way, that was the kind of initial starting point in which we were reacting against. You know, clearly, there are cases where artworks are fragile, are kind of vulnerable, but it's applied as a kind of default now, completely arbitrarily. It's nothing really to do with how the work has been made, etc. In our exhibition at the Henry Moore Institute, we actually have a Henry Moore, which is kind of rare for the Institute to be showing a Henry Moore. Henry Moores tend to be able to be touched when they're outside, but when they're brought inside, suddenly you can't touch them. So it's become a kind of default way of dealing with conservation that is really unconsidered and effectively excludes a large percentage of the population. I think the other thing that really has sparked, you know, it was a kind of sparking point really for the whole conception of the project, theoretically, was that actually a lot of provision through touch tours, etc., had a slightly off, have a slightly old-fashioned idea about what art practice is. And there's been such enormous changes in arts practice that, you know, date back now a considerable time back to the 60s and 70s with the development of performance art, the development of installation art, more political art, participatory art, etc. But there's still often this kind of, you know, notion of touching art as a kind of, you know, something that's therapeutic rather than conceptual or challenging. And we felt that actually part of what we wanted to do in this project is to say that, you know, an artwork for someone that is blind or partially blind should be every much as kind of complex and challenging and confronting even to the beholder as it is for someone that's kind of sighted. So in a way, we wanted to kind of rethink that kind of engagement and see how these novel forms or novel modes of engaging art open up these new ways of engaging specifically for the audience that's been central to the consideration, a blind and partially blind audience.
In terms of that, a lot of those assumptions that are made, it's either therapeutic for the maker, or it's, oh, let's give those people some access. So I think our approach to that, I mean, again, we could talk about this for a very long time, but our approach to getting away from that was to include access at all levels of the project. So it's not so much that we're accommodating or making things accessible for blind people. It's that that's the default and everything is accessible for everyone. We had three rules for the project. One was that the majority of the artists that would be exhibited would be blind or partially blind, that all of the works would be multisensory, and so any engagement with them would be beyond a single sense, beyond looking at something behind a rope. And the third one was that access would be embedded in all areas of the project, and that included even emails between people that are involved in the project. So the font size, navigation, wayfinding, signage, audio description, methods of audio description, they're for everyone. They're not just for ticking a box to make it accessible for those people that can't see.
I think that's also the kind of, you know, fundamental difference in this project from many early initiatives. I mean, in the 70s and 80s, there were exhibitions at Tate in London, but also the Leeds Art Gallery, An exhibition called Revelations for the Hands. And there were two exhibitions actually at Tate, one in the late 60s, one in the 70s, called Sculpture. Sorry, no, one in the 70s, one in the early 80s, 81, called Sculpture for the Blind. And there's this kind of notion that there was a special kind of sculpture that was for the blind, which kind of suggests that there's other sculpture that isn't for the blind. But there was also something slightly patronising about that. I mean, there were some very good exhibitions, and they were, you know, it was great that they recognised the need for greater accessibility. But it was something being done on behalf of the blind. And I think what's really important for this project is that blind artists have been absolutely central. And we have a blind curator, which is very rare in having Aaron. And I just, if I can, just say one more thing about that, because
please.
I kind of sometimes get frustrated when people assume that my interest in the project is purely one of altruism, you know, where I'm just interested, you know, in, you know, because I'm not blind myself. And so I'm doing it out of some kind of charitable notion. And it's not actually, you know, I'm a professor of aesthetics, and I actually think that actually if we open up artworks to these different ways of beholding, we actually start to really question what artworks are. You know, philosophers like to use this term, what the ontology of art, which just means what kind of entity an artwork is. And so actually what we're doing is fundamentally challenging what certain art practices are. And sculpture has always been a kind of art form that's been accessible through touch. And over the last kind of 30, 40 years, these conventions of not touching have completely changed the way people have engaged with kind of sculpture. So we think that this project it's not just about, it is about access, it's increasing accessibility, but it's actually starting to challenge you know, thinking about those practices in a way that opens up new knowledge. And it's something that Georgina Cleese, who's probably the foremost kind of theorist of blindness arts, always says, you know, that actually engaging sculpture through touch involves new kind of knowledges that we're not necessarily very good at, and we have to kind of educate people about, and we have to kind of develop those skills in a way. So it's a much wider question. You know, we were insistent right from the start, it's not just about access, it's about changing the way we think about those practices, those artistic practices.
Yes, I mean, Georgina mentioned recently in a radio broadcast that you know, a lot of those of us that are considering arts from a blind perspective are actually, well, we know a lot more about sightedness than the sighted do about blindness. But what Ken was saying earlier about the Revelation for the Hands and a Sculpture for the Blind, I mean, there was a story that Ken could tell about a recent incident in Athens.
Oh, maybe please. Can you?
Oh, I was just in Athens for a European Society of Aesthetics conference, and I was in the Archaeological Museum, and there were some replicas of some of the works in the exhibition, and, you know, with an invitation to touch, and I was kind of touching them and enjoying that. And I mean, it was fairly tokenistic, in all honesty, compared to the size of the exhibition. But one of the guards came up, one of the attendants came up and said, "Can you stop doing that? You're not blind."
Oh.
And I couldn't believe it. And I said, "What? You know, you know, the whole point is they're meant to be touched." "Oh, yeah, but they're only to be touched by blind people." And this kind of is symptomatic of this kind of ghettoization, and it's the exact opposite of what we're trying to do. And I had a long argument with the attendant, who agreed with me, and I won him around to the fact that actually it's really important that everyone touches, because otherwise this is something that just becomes a kind of phenomena where people look at blind people and it becomes a kind of spectacle of the blind touching the work, where everyone else steps back and just observes that, which is kind of bizarre and you know, the exact opposite of what we're trying to do in the exhibition, where everyone would engage through touch, but also through sound, through smell, through other senses, and vision. I mean, we're not trying to set up this binary between touch and vision. We're saying that all art is inherently multisensory.
One of the things that I became acquainted with, it was a phrase that I wasn't familiar with before reading about the exhibition. The phrase oculocentric bias. Could you define what oculocentric bias is for our listeners and how it relates to art?
I think oculocentric bias just means privileging the eyes over other senses. And I think it stems from a tendency earlier in philosophy and in science, in psychology, to separate out the senses, and the sense that everyone was interested in exploring over and above any other senses was sight. And that started to be challenged. You know, there are psychologists like Suzanne Miller, who was fantastic in opening up an interesting kind of tactile engagements, etc. So oculocentrism is just privileging over one sense over the other. But it does stem from this individualization, separating out the senses, rather than a kind of approach that emphasizes the interconnectedness between all the senses, which is, again, what we're trying to do.
No, in my view, is in Western society, particularly, the senses are not they're not understood, and they're not encouraged, and they're not taught. You ask a postgraduate art student, why is the sky blue, or how does the eye work, which bits do what, they don't know, which is kind of remarkable if you've been looking for many years of your life. But using the senses, we don't teach children how to use them, but they're very often, don't look like that, don't touch like that. We're not encouraging the exploration of senses. And as Ken says, the psychologists used to look at the senses in isolation, but that's not how we experience the world. The analogy I use for students often is that being in a fairground or on a roller coaster, everything is happening at the same time. Certain moments of your memory or recall will say, oh, I saw this, I smelt that, I felt this, but actually it's all happening simultaneously. So I think with the exhibition, is what we're trying to do is to open that out and get people to think about the senses. Blind people and other people with other disabilities have a particular experience of the world, so that's something they're considering all of the time, whereas in general, able-bodied people aren't confronted with that. They're not given those opportunities to make those or to have those reflections.
Could you give an example of how someone with a lived experience might experience the world in a certain way where someone else might not, and bring that to their artistic practice? Am I understanding you correctly?
Yes, I think so. I mean, an example I would give would be coming out of a door. I'm thinking my own front door. Closing the door, there's a set of steps. You're feeling the temperature. You're feeling the wind. The wind and the temperature are having an effect of the sound of the street, the trees. If there is a helicopter in the air, a police helicopter, for example, you're hearing the reflection of that helicopter from a building. I know that if it appears to be coming from the north, it's very likely to be coming from the south. Whereas if it's coming from overhead, then it's more likely to be from the north. So it's about making those decisions and those. I mean, I could go on about scent and temperature. But it's about being able to make those calls by considering those influences. I would suggest that a sighted person wouldn't necessarily think about that.
I think, just building on what Aaron's saying, one of the things that came up in a number of the workshops, Georgina Cleese talked about the 360 degree nature of blindness, her own blindness, speaking from her own lived experience. Whereas there tends to be a kind of dominance, a frontal dominance of vision where we're taking account of what's immediately in front of us, where, I think many blind people, I'm not trying to speak on their behalf, but this is something that Georgina has said, many blind people have, an awareness of what's behind as well as what's in front. And for me, that's really interesting because I think actually when you're in a kind of piece of installation art or where you're engaging with a large piece of sculpture, that kind of sense of knowing where things are in space is a really rich way of experiencing that. It's confronting this immediate sensory information to have a kind of full body experience of that work, where what's behind is just important about what's in front. I mean, it's something that the philosopher Merleau-Ponty talks about, the importance of lived experience, the fact that we kind of interact with the world through these multiple senses is absolutely fundamental to what we are as human beings. So sight can sometimes take over and close us off to those other cues, such as smell, such as sound, et cetera.
Yes.
Yeah,
Oh, sorry. I was just wondering, Ken, if your particular interest in just the space before getting involved in this exhibition, if I'm wondering if that sort of equipped you with sort of like a language so you could really understand this type of art, like quite easier than other people might. That being a focus of yours when you were just getting into the arts as an architect and so on.
I'm not sure I would claim that I understand better, but I mean, it
Yeah.
certainly sparks my kind of interest. I
Yeah.
mean, my own practice, if I, the practice I most enjoy doing as an artist are kind of interventions into existing architecture, where the whole point of the intervention is to make people more aware of the situation that they're in. I mean, one example would be a commission that I received from Corum, the children's charity in London, where they had a mortuary building which was once part of the London Foundling Hospital, which has long since been demolished, but the mortuary building on Corum's campus in London had stayed, but unfortunately it had to be demolished to make way for a new development. So the installation there was really about drawing people's attention to a building that had become a paint store and full of garden equipment. And people just walked by this and didn't even know the history of this particular building, which, had been used to prepare the bodies of children that had died, at the Foundling Hospital. So this kind of tragic kind of history and really important history. So using multi-sensory ways of opening it up involved flooding the building. So you had to take your shoes and socks off to enter into the building, opening up what had been two skylights within the two mortuary spaces that had been covered over for many years. So I opened them up. So it was open to the elements. If it rained, it came into the kind of building. But that also opened up to the sounds of the trees. And the trees are the one element that still go back to the original London Foundling Hospital. They were planted in the 18th century or late 18th century, I think it was. So they were a real tangible connection to the sounds that the children would have heard as part of their kind of daily experience. So I, this is before the project, but in a way, I think I was thinking about, rather than imposing something on that situation, an intervention that actually just you know, made people more aware, made people kind of in a way more sensory aware. There was a different way of listening, a different way of feeling through, you know, the water through your feet, a different way, and a different way of seeing the space, because the exhibition, the roof lights had apertures that focused the light entering to the building so that you got these amazing reflections from the water. At certain times of the day, particularly around midday, that you got these amazing reflections as shafts of light entered into the building, and then you got all the kind of complex patterns generated through the reflections in the water. So I suppose I had an intrinsic interest which keyed in with Aaron's in perception and widening that way that we engage the senses.
Thank you for tuning into Brainwaves tonight on 3CR. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday at 5 p.m. for the second part of our conversation with Ken and Aaron. Until then, you can find more of our shows on our website, brainwaves.org.au, or on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au. Feel free to send any feedback or suggestions for shows via email at brainwaves@wellways.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 5 p.m. for another episode of Brainwaves on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.